Good afternoon. Today is Friday, January the 18th, 18th day of the new year. Joining us this afternoon, Carol Reisch from the Humboldt Municipal Water District.
Hello, Brian.
Did I get close?
You're very close.
Very close. Okay. Carol.
And also our...
And you brought somebody along again. Yeah. Except this guy isn't nearly as old or decrepit as the old guy.
Oh, I'm not going to touch that one,
yeah,
Brian.
Yeah, I didn't think you would, but maybe John's listening, huh?
It's my honor and privilege to introduce Alderon Laird, a longtime serving board member of the district and our newly elected president.
Thank you.
Is this an honor recognition of fine effort, or did everybody else step back one?
I think it finally came around to me.
Okay. This afternoon, we'll talk a little bit about some of the state water issues that are going on. Believe it or not, there are politics involved. So I'll touch a little base on that also. But Alderon also has done a little bit of work around Humboldt Bay, some of the historical stuff. So we may end up doing yet another historical program with someone that Carol brings in. You bring in all these folks with all this experience. Knows you're not old. Winslow's old. You're not.
History.
You have experience.
Yes.
And we'll see if we can tap into that experience when we come back.
At my bank, I feel at home. I'm Trish Greggie of the Journey's End, and my bank is Redwood Capital Bank.
At my bank, hometown banking isn't just something they say, it's how they do business. I'm Kevin McClendon of Georgia's Glass, and my bank is Redwood Capital Bank.
At my bank, we invest in the future of our community every single day. I'm Greg Foster, and my bank is Redwood Capital Bank.
Redwood Capital Bank, our interest is you. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Good afternoon, KINS News and Information Time. It's 3:13. We're back to Talk Shop this afternoon with Carol Reisch and Alderon Laird. But before we do our quote this afternoon, let's see if we can find a really safe, tame one. I think I'm already scaring Carol. Al Capone, sometime between 1899 and 1947, said, quote, "Don't get the idea I'm knocking the American system." I'm more taking full advantage of the American system at that time. Carol, when some of the decisions are made by the board, whether the short-term, long-term, how much does the influence or the political environment at the state level weigh into that decision-making process?
It really depends what the issue is. I'd say the majority of the issues we deal with, it really doesn't to a very great extent. And it is one of the beauties of being separated in the water world physically from the state and federal water projects. Having our own watershed, having our own system, so we really have a lot of autonomy and a lot of separation. That doesn't say certain issues don't come up where, you know, there's important policies we need to pay attention to and advocate for. We participate in grant funding programs, and it's one of the reasons that we've maintained our membership in the Association of California Water Agencies that Alderon serves on the board for.
If we were at the same location but inland with all the diversions, much more susceptible to state politics?
Totally.
Yeah.
So it's just that we're not connected.
We're not plumbed in.
You're going to stick with those analogies, aren't you? or does the state even recognize that we're really around? Or are we just kind of, because we're not connected into the system, do they kind of forget about us and everything else is talking about the Sacramento Delta, the Bay Area, getting water down to L.A., desert versus urban encroachment, blah, 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 piping it out of the mountains? Do we get forgotten in that discussion?
Pretty much. Ever since they gave up on Dos Rios and Butler Valley Dam in the 70s, they have just forgotten about us, except for the Trinity Division for the Central Valley Project. They like our water coming out of the Trinity Alps. And so stuff that goes on in the Bay Delta has a big impact on the Trinity, which certainly impacts, you know, our fishery industry up here on the North Coast.
What about the eel? Is that kind of a forgotten...
Well, it's
also
not forgotten by Sonoma County Water Agency.
I know those boys in the wine yards.
Popular with them. But now, you know, from a water perspective, I think, you know, when they gave up on Dos Rios and creating tunnels and tapping us into the Central Valley Project, that it's still all on the books. You know, who knows, maybe a century from now, they'll dust that off and come looking again.
Does any of that stuff pencil out financially? I mean, the cost seems so horrifically large.
I think a lot of the criticisms that's leveled against the State Water Project and the Central Valley Project is that they don't do any cost-benefit analysis, and that's a lot of what's being leveled against the peripheral canals, is that the only cost-benefit analysis that's been done, it was at the University of the Pacific in Stockton, yet the Bay Delta Conservation Planning Effort and the Delta Stewardship Council don't use it, and they don't look at it.
Just blow it off entirely?
Blow it off entirely, because it didn't come out very favorable as cost-benefit.
So. Well, you got to like the attitude. If it doesn't show me what I want, then let's find one that does. Oh, boy. The future of water. Has anybody really put a good circle around what we're talking about? Wasn't desalinization a big deal 25 years ago? That was going to be the big saving for San Diego and L.A. And
the thing
then
with
something
desal,
happened,
though, is it has such a huge, needs a really big electrical plug to run it. It takes so much energy that you spend more money on energy than you would going after other sources of water.
Well, but they didn't slow us up with ethanol.
No, and they are pursuing it in San Diego. They just approved moving forward with their big operation down there by Oceanside. So they're going to build one of the largest desal plants on the West Coast. I think it'll have a capacity of like 50 million gallons
a
day. Yeah,
50 million gallons per day, right. Yeah.
How does that relate to anything that's around here?
That's about how much we delivered to the two mills. We delivered we could have delivered up to 60 million gallons a day. And so right now our municipal customers, the maximum they ever take is maybe 20 million gallons a day. So it's a lot bigger than what we use. And
so if the energy cost or investment is so huge in this, are they that desperate for water?
Yeah.
Or is this a test run?
No, I think they're desperate. They want a different supply. They are thinking that the Colorado River water that they've been getting, ultimately they're going to lose access to. And so the desal will be about 10 or 15% of their water portfolio, and they're planning ahead to replace losing the Colorado water. And they're also, you know, they're at the end of the pipe, they say, for California's water, and they worry about the plumbers up north, you know, changing things, and they're not going to get their fair share of water.
Does he keep going back to these plumbing references throughout all the
meetings? Hey, it works for our business, Brian. You know?
Yeah, I know, it all flows downhill. Good. KINS, News and Information Time. It's 3:19. We'll be back with more from Alderon Laird and Carol Riche.
Now a minute of sunshine for Humboldt. Nowadays, it's cold outside, especially if you can't afford warm winter coats for your children. That's where Coats for the Cold comes in. This homegrown organization collects donated coats, cleans them, and distributes them to needy people. It began in 2008 when Robert Lone saw sharply reduced coat prices in a store, bought a batch, and donated them to the Eureka Rescue Mission. Beginning late in January, Coats for the Cold will give out over 1,000 coats in the county, now including southern communities. To donate a coat, new or lightly used, there are 50 Humboldt locations where you can drop it off this month. Find them on this website, coatsforthecold.org. That's coatsforthecold.org. Volunteers from Teen Challenge and other organizations will give out the coats to children. Your warm heart can keep them warm this winter. Sunshine for Humboldt is a nonprofit civic association dedicated to the people and places that make this a good place to live.
Good afternoon, KINS. News and Information Times, 3:24. We're back to Talk Shop this afternoon with Alderon Laird and Carol Riche. When we think of anything state project-wise, efficiencies don't tend to be one of those words that rise to the surface, for me at least. So as the state is contemplating some of these significant projects, why should anybody think that they're going to do a better job dealing with water and pipes and dynamite than they've been able to do with, take your pick of anything else that the state's got their hands in?
Well, actually, I think that, you know, on a global scale, the water system that California has is one of the best plumbing systems that's ever been developed on this big of a landscape. They just have a missing piece in it. But as far as water systems and engineering go, you know, the California water projects are right up there at the top. So,
however, when we talk about paying for it and financing and the financial structure of what the state currently is, I don't think the same could be said.
No. Financing is a whole different world. I mean, the common way of paying for these big projects is general bonds and general fund bonds. And that means, you know, everybody that pays taxes pays for that. And
it's not a user focused.
No, if it was user focused, you know, 80% of the developed water goes to agriculture. But I would say that probably 95% of the general bonds are funded by people living in urban centers on the coast and in Southern California. So, you know, that's just the way we've always financed big projects.
What was it, 10, 20 years ago? Maybe it was in the late 70s when the El Nino cycle was in mm-hmm. play. And there were comments being made that people in Sacramento were paying less for Trinity River water than people in Humboldt County were. I know water contracts are in there and things are kind of goofy
mm-hmm.
with the Russian River or Eel River South. But with something like this, Alderaan, are they talking about water contracts or are they just talking about rape and pillage and thank you very much?
Well, the projects that are being planned, the two peripheral tunnels, is really part of the state water project. So it's for the state portion, although the Central Valley project, which is federal, will benefit from the tunnels being built also. So they're partnering with the Bay Delta Conservation Plan and the other environmental documents. But, you know, Sacramento, I don't know if it's different now, but up until just recent times, they didn't have water monitors, so they didn't pay water meters. So, you know, they didn't pay based on how much they use. They just paid a flat rate. So, you know, when water is precious and it means something to you, especially for delivering at the cost of it, you meter it and you charge a progressive rate. You know, the more you use, the higher you pay for. But there's a lot of water agencies, particularly agricultural districts, you know, where they don't charge you based on that volume.
So when they're considering either of these two projects, is there any, I don't know, maybe too strong to say accountability, but any connection with use and fees being paid?
Well, one of the things that happened in 2009 is we passed a block of water bills. And one of the water bills that was passed is that for the first time, California was actually going to measure how much water we consume. We didn't really know how much we're actually using. And so it requires now that agriculture develop water efficiency measures and conservation measures, but also that they monitor how much groundwater they actually use so we could figure out how much groundwater, how much surface water. We could figure out how big is our water appetite, you know, how much do we need, you know, to satisfy everybody's needs. I mean, that's the biggest complaint of the environmental community is that the state and the federal water projects have sold more water than they have water in reality. And so there's always a water shortage.
That sounds like triple net to me. That doesn't sound too shabby.
Yeah.
Depends which side of the equation you're on.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So are there a lot of communities that don't have water meters?
I think in the Central Valley that may be the case. You know, there's a lot of little communities in the Central Valley, particularly in the southern part of the valley, in San Joaquin, where they rely on groundwater, well water. And they have a real water quality problem because of the runoff from the agriculture and nitrates and things like that. But I don't know. You know, I'm most familiar with our regional system, and it's very well measured and metered. We know what everybody uses.
I know Sacramento and Davis was not metered, but there is now legislation for them to do that. I think most of the metropolitan areas in Southern California are all metered, yes. But it was definitely prevalent in the Sacramento region.
That is just so bizarre. Or different a thought than what we're accustomed to.
Exactly. Well, especially for a precious resource or a scarce resource.
Or what we just done battle about over the years.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. Where do fish come into this? Or do they?
They do come into it in the, you know, the Sacramento run of the Chinook is listed, the winter run. And, you know, the fish that live in the Delta aren't doing so good. The fish that have to go through the Delta aren't doing very well, you know, in the... The fish populations there, just as well as up on the north coast, have collapsed. There's a lot of listed species, you know, the Delta smelt, longfin smelt, and
Jimmy Smith talked about it.
Yeah,
you know, over a series of years. But my understanding was it was always going to be fish against people against wine, and that triangle was pretty much covering most of the discussions we would ever have in our area.
I think that's the advocacy triangle. You know, those are the groups, you know, that come to, you know, to discuss or do battle or whatnot. But really, you know, the Delta is an area that's, you know, is a crisis waiting to happen. I mean, it's if we have a major earthquake event, all the dikes and levees in the Delta collapse. The San Francisco Bay rushes in. It becomes salt water overnight. Nobody will be able to draw water there for agriculture or for urban uses. If we have sea level rise, I mean, all that area will be, you know, covered with salt water. And then we have atmospheric rivers.
KINS, News and Information Times, 3:30.
This is Fred Van Fleck, Eureka City Schools Superintendent. Exciting new things are happening in our district next year. Reducing our kinder through third grade class size to 23-1. Eliminating our combination classes. And the reopening of Winship Middle School. Remember, we are the largest district on the North Coast, allowing us to have the most diverse course in extracurricular offerings. Enrollment is happening now through January 25th. Please stop by the district office across from Eureka High School or visit the website at eurekacityschools.org.
Good afternoon, KINS, News and Information Times, 3:35. We're back to Talk Shop this afternoon with Carol Reisch and Alderon Laird from the Water District. Humboldt Bay. A lot of people talk about this as a jewel. Alderon, does the bay resemble anything what the bay resembled when it was first stumbled upon in the 1850s?
Well, the bay itself, you know, the water bodies and the mudflats, those look pretty similar to what they did before, but the necklace or the fringe of salt marsh that was around the bay, that's been pretty much wiped out. And so the total footprint of the bay has been reduced by about a third.
Because of the dikes and the levees and that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
What were the spits like?
The spits, they were pretty much the same configuration that they're in right now. South spit was pretty narrow, north spit. The thing that changed is when they put the jetties going out there, it funneled the wave energy as it came into the bay, and it directed it right at Bunay Point, and it eroded Bunay Point. It was called Red Hill. And what's left of Bunay Point now is just the backside of it. And all of that material that was Bunay Point circulated in the bay and formed the Elk River Spit. That's where the spit material came from, was the erosion of Bunay Point.
So it's still within the bay. It doesn't flush out, so to speak.
It didn't flush out. You know, mostly the sediment comes in the bay rather than going out.
Because of the drift coming down the coast,
yeah,
or up the coast, depending
on the littoral drift of the sand coming up the coast, yeah.
So the spits were not out as far or as narrow in the mouth as it currently is? It was a wider mouth? Or
no,
was
it was
about
the same size. It was about the same size. I think when they built the jetties, they pretty much kept the same opening width. They just changed the direction of the entrance.
Okay. South Bay. Mm-hmm. We've heard that there was a lot of commerce there. We've heard there was a lot of wildlife there. There were a couple of the Indian tribes that were there. What did the southern part, sounds like it's really big, huh? What did South Bay, what did it look like?
Well, it had, you know, Table Bluff and that hill. That's the only place where we have a vertical cliff dropping right into the bay, right to the foot of the water. Then that was forested, and there was an extensive redwood forest down in Salmon Creek, you know, that came all the way down to the salt marsh. And when they cleared those areas first, you know, for farming and agriculture, you know, they started down by the bay and worked their way up the valley. There was Southport, you know, down by towards Table Bluff. And that was an area where people would bring agricultural products from the Eel River Valley, the Delta, and get it onto a landing, and then they could get it on a ship and then get it to San Francisco. And so Southport had quite a bit of commerce. It was a real busy area. And when they got the entrance to Humboldt Bay more established and safer, you know, they had pilots that were more familiar with it, they just sort of bypassed that and went on up to, and through the bay.
Came around either to Bucksport or to Eureka proper.
Yeah, that really is right.
There seems to be, at least with some of the older maps, an awful lot of creeks that feed into the bay.
Mm-hmm.
Now a lot of them have asphalt on top of them or fill and this or that. How much water is actually, and I guess it would be called seeping now rather than running into the bay from, let's say Herrick Overpass, Humboldt Hill-ish, through and around to Arcata?
I think that most of all those natural streams got channelized, you know, and they're in culverts underground, and they still ultimately discharge. Fish and Wildlife Service did a water control survey of the entire bay, and they identified where all the culverts and tide gates are. So there's a lot of openings where those streams still feed into the bay. And most of the major streams or rivers like Elk River, Jacoby Creek, or Freshwater, you know, they're still flowing into the bay, and they didn't get altered. But a lot of things got channelized, you know, and Salmon Creek really got manipulated around. It used to flow to White Slough area, and now it more exits down by Hookton Slough.
Is there a map showing where these, whether they're culverts or diversions, or where they are underneath?
Yes, there is. I just finished putting together a GIS database of Humboldt Bay, and I mapped and inventoried the entire shoreline. And one of the layers on that is where all the water control devices are, the culverts, and where all the tide gates are. I built on the work that was done by Fish and Wildlife in 2007, and we added like 70 new structures on there. We also identified and built on a previous survey where all the salt marsh is around Humboldt Bay. And we mapped what the shoreline's made up. We know where all the dikes are, where all the bulk works are, where all the rock riprap is. We know how many miles of everything. We know what the elevation is of the entire shoreline. So we were able to identify what parts of the shoreline would be at risk with 1, 2, or 3 feet of sea level rise, or even 6 feet.
KINS, News and Information Times, 341. We'll be back with more from Alderon Laird and a little bit more from Carol Reisch.
Sacred Heart Church invites you to join us every Sunday for our liturgical celebrations. Saturday, 4 p.m. Confessions. 5 p.m. Sunday's Vigil Mass. 7 p.m. Spanish Mass. And on Sundays, 9:30 Morning Mass and 12:30 Spanish Mass. Come and celebrate with us.
Good afternoon, KINS, News and Information Times, 345. We're back to Talk Shop this afternoon with Alderon Laird and Carol Reisch. Alderon, when you were working on the Bay project that you were referencing, what was the biggest surprise?
The biggest surprise? Good. Almost getting tipped over by submerged pilings on my kayak. That was a pretty big surprise one day.
And, just not seeing them?
Yeah. There was piling sticking up, but every now and then there will be a piling that was cut off lower. It was just under the surface of the water.
I gotcha.
And you're just going along mapping and minding your own business, and all of a sudden you're almost tipping over. And so that wasn't too much fun. That made me a lot more alert after that. So wherever I saw a piling, I gave it a lot of berth and moved out and stuff. It was pretty unique being out in the low tide channels. I kayaked out into the center of South Bay during a low tide. It was just turning, starting to rise. And to be way out there with all the seals, you know, out in the middle of the bay. And then as the water just reaches the level of the mudflats, gazillions of egrets and herons and birds just come flying in, and they're having a feeding frenzy out there, and they completely ignore that you're there, and they're just squawking. And it was really fascinating because it's way out in the middle of the mudflats, so we never see that from the shoreline. And if you get out there, it's a fascinating world.
Nature's kind of fun sometimes.
It is.
Yeah. It is. Unless you tip over in the middle of the mud.
Well, being out in the middle of that little channel, I realized all of these seals are surrounding me, and they look about as big as I am. And I thought they were going to start playing around with my kayak. I could be in trouble real quick.
You need to take along some heavier ballast with you. You'd mentioned in the last segment a little bit about the sea level, and certainly over the millennia there's been ups and downs. And could you see any historical stuff with the earthquake fault on the Mad River? Mm-hmm. It leaves its mark. Well, could you see a mark of when the water was higher, when the water was lower, any of that kind of stuff?
There's places like out in Mad River Slough when you're kayaking, and if you look about 3 feet down from the top of the bank, you'll see these old Sitka spruce roots sticking out from the bed. And that's from when we had that Cascadia event in 1700, and the whole bottom dropped about 3 feet, and all the forest standing died in the salt water. Well, you can see where they were, and you can see how much it dropped down. And so it's like a real-world reality check, is that this whole landscape that seems so stable right now can really, you know, just drop all of a sudden. We're 3 feet lower, and the ocean's rushing in.
How deep was the bay before the dredging and everything else?
The entrance of the bay?
Take your favorite spots or reference points that we might recognize.
Well, the entrance, they dredged the entrance, I think, to 40 feet or 48 feet, and the inner channels to 30 feet. I think naturally the entrance of the bay was probably, you know, like 10, 15 feet, you know, on a medium tide. And I think the channels going up Arcata Bay and down into South Bay, you know, they haven't dredged those in a long, long time. And I think they're probably back to what their natural depths are.
As the sea level changes, what do you see? Is there a risk factor that you see around the bay? If, let's say, I don't know, I don't even know what's reality. So let's use simple-minded figures here. A foot, 2 feet, and 3 feet.
Okay.
And, you know, whether that's in 3,000 years or whatever.
The tipping point is between 2 and 3 feet.
Okay, so if it goes up 1 foot, we just got a little bit more water?
No, because every year we have what we call now king high tides. It's the extreme high tide in the winter. And that adds about a foot on to our monthly maximum high tide. So we see 1 foot of sea level rise every year for a couple of days. If we have an El Nino event, you can add another foot onto that. So if the eustatic sea level rise, the global sea level, goes up a foot, then all of those maximum high tides go up another foot. And what we found is that 2 feet of sea level rise, from whatever cause, is the tipping point. Once you go beyond 2 feet, you lose almost 40-50% of all the dikes on Humboldt Bay.
Now, is that because they are still the old mud, they haven't been repaired, and they're not
It's a historical legacy that was built. They started building these in the 1890s, and they built them just high enough to be above the highest high tides and not really much higher. And so they're all about 10 foot elevation. And what we've had over the last century is the ground has dropped because we're tectonically active, so we've had subsidence. The ocean has gone up about 8 inches. And when you look at the record at the North Spit Station, we have the highest rate of sea level rise in the entire west coast of the United States, 18.6 inches over a century of time, whereas the rest of the country or the rest of the coast is on the order of 8 inches. And it's because of the subsidence. The ground here is dropping, whereas everywhere else on the Tecton or the Cascadia event, it's going up. Like Crescent City, there's no sea level rise. The ground's matching the elevation change in the ocean.
I would have thought it was just muck. Thanks for coming by, guys.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Hi, Carol.
Hey, Brian.
Bye-bye.
No, this was by design to bring in some of Alderon's really unique experiences.
Fun, fun, fun. Join us Monday afternoon for more Talk Shop. Till then, go out and make it a good day. Hug someone you love. See you tomorrow morning.